Wine is unlike anything else that I can think of.
Sometimes with all the glitz and glamour of Napa, we forget this whole thing is based on families growing grapes, you know?
Potentially, this is a fantastic year, but anything can change on a dime, right?
And everything's good in life, you just have to make a natural judgment, not be too tricky in your mind. I like it, I don't like it.
Davis himself thinks that it's kind of a big load of hooey. People probably use more than maybe two or three descriptors for a wine. He just thinks they're just making it up.
I kind of fired myself. I mean, I couldn't be a one-man operation forever.
There's always something to do. There's replanting, there's barrels, there's maintenance.
Because so many people use mobile bottling lines right now, and everything has to come, the labels, the corks, everything has to come together at the same time and be there when the truck shows up.
Being able to grow up in wine, you have this passion and love for wine and the culture of wine, and everything else sort of pales in comparison.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 243. This week we feature Daryl Eklund of Paramon USA, a cork manufacturer.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Every wine tells a story. Each growing season, it's our goal to create an artisan Napa Valley wine of exceptional quality. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
From time to time, we like to delve into an even deeper area of winemaking that can be regarded as behind the curtain. For this podcast, we met with Daryl Eklund of Paramon USA, a cork manufacturer. Daryl is U.S. sales manager for Paramon and operates out of Napa Valley. We spoke with Daryl earlier this year to try and get a better handle on how this whole cork thing works.
We're here in Napa Valley, and we're in the city of Napa, and we have kind of a different interview today. We're here with Daryl Eklund, and Daryl is with Paramon, which is a cork manufacturer, and kind of a different exploration into the backgrounds of wine today. How are you doing, Daryl?
Very well today. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. Thanks for seeing me. Let's start with this idea that you're a winemaker.
Yeah, I was a Davis grad and started in the 70s working for Trefeth as assistant winemaker, and then ran Con Creek Winery for 8 years, and another winery that's now Luna for 6 years is Vineyard Winery Management. Wow. And then I got into sales while I to support my Pinot Noir habit. And so I made my own Pinot Noir for 7 years. And then you're talking about going and talk to the Franks. There was a fire at one of their warehouses that burned up all my inventory.
Aye.
And that's when they offered me to become general manager for the Amarum Cork. At that point, I had kids put through college, so that really was the end of my winemaking career. But I've done very well in sales. Sales has been good to me and to my family.
Do you make your own wine at home at all?
No, but you never lose the passion. Yeah. Like I told, I went down to the Zinfandel and Associates, the Zap Tasting in San Francisco yesterday, and a lot of those people are friends. You've known them for a lot of years.
Sure. Yeah.
And you just enjoy talking to them about wine and how they make their wine and what they see. And that's one thing that's made me kind of unusual being in the sales side is I've been on both sides of the desk. I've been the recipient and the deliverer of the sales pitch. And so you know what a winemaker is really looking for.
Sure.
I mean, he has 25 things to do that day, and you're one of them. And it's amazing to me that people that are in sales, or when I have junior salesmen talking to me, they're not sitting there waiting for you to make a pitch and rebunk it. You're in there to make a sale, get in, get out, and let them make their decisions. So, I mean, it's amazing that the way people think about winemakers is these gods, and they're guys just trying to make a good product. And
yeah.
There's many aspects to making that product, and buying closures or packaging supplies is just one of them. There's no classes at Davis about packaging supplies. You learn it on the job, and usually when you get to a certain stage, then you delegate it to an assistant winemaker or somebody like that to make sure everything gets there on time so that the bottling comes off. And right now it's even more of a objective or a key thing, because so many people use mobile bottling lines right now, and everything has to come, the labels, the corks, everything has to come together at the same time and be there when the truck shows up. Because if you miss your truck, you're not going to see them again until September during harvest, and then bottling during harvest is a major pain in the...
I can't even imagine.
No, it is. There's just too many variables.
Let's talk about Paramon specifically. So explain to me what Paramon does.
Paramon is what we'd call a craft boutique cork manufacturer. It's only making 80 million closures. And when I worked for Amrum, Amrum at this point is making 4 billion closures a year. And the logistics are just a nightmare, trying to take the bark to make all these different things. They have a whole department that does that. So at this point, I mean, it's a family-run operation. Frances Paramount took over from his father and uncle in the 90s. And decided at that point that, seeing all the alternative closures coming along, that the only place that he thought that the future lay for him and their product was to make high-end natural corks. And so he and his father are the ones that go out to all the various forests in Spain and buy the wood and bring it back. They make a big point about handcrafting, about curing the wood, leaving it in curing sheds for 12 months, which is very old-fashioned. Mm. Everything is processed without no human contact. It's all automatic. And the thing I like about Paramon is that he's really, really good at machines. He's the first guy to develop laser printers. We all played with it, but it's so slow that the bigger and more industrial guys can't do it. It runs about one-third the speed of an ink printer. But because of his size, he can do that. And he's the first guy that generated automatic cork punching, automatic laser sorting machines, rather than having women stand at these tables for hours on end sorting out bad cork. And he's really, 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 the beautiful thing I think that struck me about it was just the quality and the evenness of the quality of the various sorts and the various lots and various grades that he makes, how uniform they are. So that's really kind of what he does. It's a niche market, and we're dealing with high-end corks, and they've been in business since 1956 in Europe, and now they're just entering into the United States market and into South Africa. So they hired me to come on and introduce it to this market.
How long have you been with the company?
About 18 months.
Oh, okay, so it's brand new.
Yeah, well, a year ago, we didn't even have anything. I mean, January of 2016, we just had a corporation. We didn't have banking. We didn't have accounting. We didn't have anything. So, I mean, it's really just a start. It's a startup.
Is it strictly corks or is it other closures as well?
They do. They have a new facility right there on their little campus that does bar top closures. Mm-hmm. And they make a product called a Microtech, which is a variant of what they call microagglomerated corks, where after they get through punching the corks out of the bark, there's a lot of the biomass is left of the bark, and everybody does this, but they, because of the high quality of wood that they use, they make a product called Microtech, which they take the bark and the cambium layers off of it, which a lot of people don't do, then they grind it, and then they put it out into and make it into a molded product for a lot of their customers who use the high-end corks also have lower-end corks, and that's what they sold. So out of the 80 million, that's about 30 million of them, but 50 million of it is the high-end natural corks.
But nothing else in terms of screw tops or glass enclosures or anything like that?
No, nope, no.
So I'm going to guess, you're a big fan of cork closures.
Yeah. There's one time I went up and did a Master Sommelier presentation in Yonville, and I was lead speaker, and they had somebody from Nomacork, which was the synthetic closure, and they had somebody from Amcor, which is the lead screw cap thing. And I said, we're going to come up here and we're talking about the strengths and weaknesses of our product. I'm going to talk to you about natural cork and how it's good for nature and has, it's got tradition, but how we're going to fight TCA. The synthetic guys are coming here and talk about, how uniform their products are, but how they're fighting oxidation, early oxidation. The screw cap guys are going to talk about their product, but they're going to tell you what they're doing to avoid, torquing issues and hermetically sealed problems and reduction. So every one of the products has a positive and a negative to it, and we're all battling it. So
yeah, just like any other product. I mean, how many companies go out and put together research pieces on why their competitor's product is no good, whereas that's just simply enough pointing out the flaws in any particular product. Mm-hmm. But cork is a very unique item because obviously one, you're getting it from Spain or Portugal, and number two, it's the cost of it adds to the price of a bottle of wine, especially when you're making finer cork, right? I mean, that's something that people need to keep in mind when they look at a price and kind of but a better cork creates a better closure. Why?
The better closures are it's kind of a progressive thing. I mean, if you go back to when I was a winemaker in the 80s and early 90s, in the 80s, there was what we call the cork epidemic, a cork taint epidemic. And it was just because that the high demand and the sudden increase in the California wine industry created this huge demand for corks, and a lot of shortcuts were taken. And that beget, I mean, the first early synthetic closures was called CelluCork, which I tried probably in 1990, and it leaked all over the place. I mean, it was just, the first ones were just tremendously bad. They're plugs, they're little plugs of corks. So, I mean, but you look back then, and if the cork industry had done back then what they've done now, then they wouldn't have allowed the market share loss that they have because, you know, they said, oh, nobody's going to use screw caps, nobody's using these plastic corks. And it wasn't probably like 10 years later where they really started taking it seriously. And one of the big breakthroughs, I think, let me get back to your question, why cork? I think it's a proven closure. It plays to traditional winemaking. If you are going to use a synthetic closure, it's going to be in a wine that's going to turn quickly, which is a lot of wines. So, I mean, you can do that. Just don't, you better sell it through. If you're going to use screw caps, you have to change your winemaking to make sure that you're in, you don't use too much sulfur, or you have to adjust your winemaking techniques, make sure that it's ready for a hermetic environment, because you're just not going to have them for the oxygen, the headspace after that. And even then, they're putting liquid nitrogen before the wine goes in. So that's it. The cork is a known feature. It really makes a lot of sense to winemakers who like it. And there's also the expectation of, especially in the premium end, the high end, and this is where Francesca was right, the high end of natural corks, if you're out to a white tablecloth restaurant and somebody's going to pull a cork for you, it's kind of strange to pull a screw cap off. I mean, yeah. There's the perception out there of cork is still of high quality. And so it's really funny because I'll tell you another story. One of the guys we broke through on cork with was Fred Franzi at Bronco. I mean, one of the biggest producers in the, and he's a character. And we sat down there and we started using this product called a Twin Top. And we sold millions, hundreds of millions of corks to him. And I sit there and go, what about screw caps, Fred? And he goes, you know, it took my family a generation to get out of screw caps. I'm not going to go back anytime soon. The people of our generation remember when California wines were associated with cheap jug screw cap wines. Right. And you go to the Gen Xers and the Millennials, and it doesn't. But, I mean, the Millennials we find are open to almost anything. But still, they, as a group, associate corks with a fine wine.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Want to kind of let our listeners know the difference between an average cork and a fine wine cork in terms of what that cost is to a winemaker and you know, their investment into that to that particular bottle of wine.
Boy, it's a huge range. I mean, if you're in a manufactured cork, what we call technical closures, where they take the waste that's left over from the cork and they grind it up and they either put discs on the ends or they sell it as a agglomerated cork, what they call microagglomerateds now. Those things can go down to half a cent a piece. And I'm dealing with one really well-known major winemaker in California right now. I mean, in Napa here, whose wines sell for $450 a bottle. And he's paying $3 a cork.
Wow, that's a high price.
Yeah, but I mean, you got to think about it.
Well, for that kind of price bottle, sure, it's a wash. But
if he wants, it's a custom. This is the most incredibly perfect cork I've ever sold in my life. Wow. I mean, everything is a custom sort. I mean, mirror ends. By mirror ends, there's no cracks, no nothing at the end. So he just wants mirror ends. And because we buy Paramon, we buy this very high quality wood to make high quality corks. We're the one company that can do that, that will do it.
Are these huge planks? Are they, we think of wood as, you know, pieces you would see at a lumber yard. But when I think about cork, I tend to think more of the bark.
Obviously. Have you ever been over there? Have you been to Portugal or Spain? Or have you seen the cork harvest?
No.
Because, I mean, there's a narrow window of time during the summer where there's enough water on the corks where it's not wet. So you won't expose the tree. So you have to wait until the rains finish. But there still has to be enough moisture in the cambium layer for the cork to separate. And so you make the stuff out, and it comes off kind of like in a round piece.
Yeah, that's what I've had in I've seen cork trees.
Yeah, but I mean, they're all over they're a natural tree to plant over here. They're a Mediterranean tree. You know why cork is there? Genetically, they think that around the Mediterranean, they have all these grass fires during the summers. And the cork tree converted to making this bark that has all this air pockets in it to make it resistant to fires.
Fire, yes.
You know,
I've heard that before.
So in Portugal or Spain or Greece or Morocco or any place where these trees are, if a wildfire goes through, it'll kill all the young oak trees, but the older oak trees will live because the bark won't catch fire and go up the tree.
All right, so here's my $64,000 question then. If, you know, they can be grown here, and we see them grown here, why wouldn't cork be harvested here in Napa Valley?
It's the infrastructure needed to process it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's a very specific set of equipment and people and knowledge that has to be done. Yeah, it grows over here. Have you ever been to UC Davis?
Actually, no, believe it or not.
Yeah. In the center of UC Davis, there's a quad. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's these big oak trees. And when I was a student, I never even noticed them. But going back there, they were planted. One of the tenants of UC Davis, when it used to be the university farm for UC Berkeley, mm-hmm. and one of the tenants was for them to explore improvements in wines and in cork closures. I mean, it's written down.
Yeah.
And so they have these huge oak trees that are planted around the quad, and they're cork oaks. And they're like 2.5-3 foot through. I mean, and they've never been stripped.
Well, let's go back to that real quick. So a cork tree is actually oak, is what you're telling me, which I didn't know either. I thought a cork tree was a cork tree.
It's an oak. It's quercus. Quercus is
oak. Very specific kind
quercus
of oak.
Quercus super and suberin, and actually the oil inside of cork is called suberin that allows it to have its pliability and not dry out. But you know, for me, I think that to go back to your question about making it, the what we buy is the planks. There's a pre-processing where the growers buy it, and then they give it a light preliminary boiling and flatten it, and then we buy the wood from them, and then we go to the same guys every year, and actually, Francesca and his father will actually do all the buying themselves from the people they've known that are high quality buyers, and they like them because they pay right there. You know, rather than somebody having to chase them for money, they play right there. They take the wood, they bring it back to their own place, and they cure it, you know, for the 12 months, which is, nobody does that anymore. And so, I mean, that's, they get the pick of the litter, really.
Is it cured before it gets here, or it's cured over there?
It's cured over there. And the curing, you know, most winemakers, you know, when you're selling to somebody, you're talking to them, what's in it for me? And what's curing do? Well, it doesn't really do a lot about TCA or any of the things that concern a winemaker. What it really does is it allows the wood to come down to a uniform moisture. And so the wood is like an oak stave. You cure oak staves.
Yeah, sure.
So that, you know, they work. But it makes the wood more workable. And so when, you probably haven't seen raw corks before. But in making a raw, a cork, you form it. Sure. And so what happens is if you cut corks and like I said, during the 80s when there was a demand, people started shortcutting that. And you're cutting corks when they're green, they split and they have cracks and they have what they call green wood, which, you know, allows for leakage. So the curing is an important part, not only for making a more perfect cork, but also to cut down on defects and the rejection level of the corks that you're going to do. So, I mean, it makes sense, and it's the way the industry used to do it. But like I said, we're about the only company that does it anymore.
The corks that are rejected, then those get ground up and for an alternative use? Then?
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh.
Interesting. So when they come here, you know, once they've been cured and they've been shipped over here, mm-hmm. you're basically designing corks for the winemakers as they need them, cutting them whatever type, whatever their specs
are. Well, I mentioned that thing, the one account I'm dealing with, and that's custom. But everybody has standard grades.
Sure.
And so sell the standard grade, and this is what we make all the time.
But you have some wineries that probably have different specs, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Like yeah. And that's one rule of sales. You know, there's no rules. Everybody has a different way of dealing with closures and incoming quality control. Sure. From nothing to very, very intense 100 cork soaks, TCA analysis at laboratories and requirements for, you know, I don't want this or I want that. So, I mean, you just have to go in. That's part of the sales process, is learning what the customer is looking for and deciding whether you can or can't supply it.
Are you selling cork strictly here in Napa, or are you selling them all over the country? Or?
Mostly we're focused right now on Napa and Sonoma. I mean, the way that we're going to establish this company is by top down and go for the high-end companies.
Are there a lot of other cork suppliers here in town? Other than the one you've mentioned?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Not as many as there used to be, I mean, the major industrial guys are here and in Sonoma.
Okay. It's kind of interesting because, you know, guys like you, much like Cooper's, you're all definitely behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. And consumers don't get to see this process of a cork and how interesting it really is. And of course, obviously, how important it is. Now, my question to you as a supplier, I guess, / manufacturer, is when you run into corked wines, when you run into any kind of defects with wines, I mean, that's obviously a big concern mm-hmm. for buyers and a much bigger concern for winemakers. How do you deal with that situation?
I think the key thing is preventative. It's preventative.
Okay, when you say preventative, what do you do?
Everything. I think if you go back, like I said, I had one instance when I was a winemaker where I made a small lot of a second label, and you take a case of wine, and three bottles were shot through with TCA. Three bottles were normal, and the wines in there were six bottles in between that were suppressed fruit for some reason or another. That's your biggest fear, is that wine gets out there and somebody tastes it, and then you they say, I'm never going to buy that wine again.
Right.
Is those what I call the gray area ones, where it's just not, it's fine. So the winemakers themselves have preventative measures for them. But for us as industry, from where the industry was when I first got into it to what now is the prevention. And the biggest thing that I was a part of, there's a group of wineries, cork producers, called Cork Quality Council. And it was formed basically to, you know, to say the positive message of cork and everything. And everybody said, what are you guys going to do about TCA? And in the late 90s, they partnered with a very reputable enological laboratory in St. Helena called ETS, Enological Technical Services, and a really brilliant chemist that runs it, Gordon Burns. And we did all these studies on corks and how to test corks for TCA. And by the year 2000, we had a protocol for testing corks for TCA. And the early protocols were really loose. I mean, I look back at it now and kind of shudder, but we developed this protocol. And the big thing was when we took it back to Portugal and said, guys, we can do this. And they all tried to debunk it, and they sent their scientists over here, and they went into his lab, which is beautiful, beautiful professional laboratory. And they went back and said, this is the way of the future. Now it's almost standard all the way through the industry for everybody to do this testing for TCA. This SPEMI, solid phase micro extraction, liquid, you know, gas chromatography micro spec,
yeah,
mass spec.
Oh, I know all about that. Yeah.
But that's really what the technology that had to be applied to be able to do this prevention,
sure,
of the product getting through.
Again, wine lovers, you know, there's always the debate between the cork, the glass, the screw top, but the idea of knowing what's behind it and how, like wine, you know, a cork is somewhat of a, more of a living organism, and it serves a very definite purpose. And in the end, this aids aging, right?
It's amazing to me that, it's a real unusual specific skill set to understand cork. You know, I'm probably one of 100 people in the United States that really understands it really, really well. And running Amrum's the big dog. I mean, it's bigger than the next four companies put together. I was the guy at the New York Times. They wanted a quote on cork. I was the guy they called.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, you're used to representing the industry. And you're kind of proud the industry finally turned itself around and did the right things, and they're doing things. So I mean, from that point of view, I think that you're happy that you're kind of frustrated that it took them that long to get into it, but you're happy that they finally have addressed it. And one thing I really want to add in here right now is the cork by cork testing. And the one thing that Paramon does, because we're small and because we're, there's these electronic sniffers, if you will, if you want to talk, they're cork detectors that can detect TCA down to, and it's really funny, why does the human nose detect TCA down to, you know, 2 parts per trillion? You know, like I said, a teaspoon of TCA could corrupt all the wine in the Napa Valley. It's amazing. Why is the human nose, you know, I mean, most thresholds you're talking like volatile acid, like vinegar, acetic acid, you're talking, you know, 100 parts per thousand. You know, and sugar, you're talking about, you know, 0.4 grams per liter. I mean, you're talking about, you know, small amounts. Why does human nose detect TCA like that? You know, we don't know, but it does.
In our evolution, we might have learned from our pets.
Well, in our evolution, we think, you know, my pet theory is that we were able to smell dank caves.
Sure.
And that was part of our ability to live, was to identify these smells of places where you could hide.
And smell is obviously that major sense, the memory sense. That's, I mean, for me, that stays with you forever.
Yeah. And it's really amazing the variation in people's sensory abilities. You know, for the super sniffers, I was in a wine tasting group for 13 years with a guy named Tom Rinaldi.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know Tom.
No, everybody
he
knows
is
Tom.
A character, yes.
But man, what a nose that guy had.
Yeah, I've heard that from many, many people.
Yeah.
He's very respected for his
nose. They call him super sniffers just because of that. They have that many more nerve endings that can detect that and pull it apart in their brain. I'd smell the wine. I was a good winemaker, very good at times. And you could pull the wines apart to a certain level and smell this part and that part. But he could just poof, blow it out. Oh, there's that Petit Verdot, and there's that, and there's Malbec, and you kind of go, wow.
You know? Some people like that are amazing.
They're like that. But the same thing happens like with cork. And some people can get TCA. I know winemakers have said, I can't smell TCA below 20 parts per trillion, which is nothing. But you know, some people can detect it down to 2 parts per trillion. So you have the same group of people around a taste. You know, they'll do these cork trials, and somebody will say, I got this one or that. And a lot of times when you're doing that, you'll go out, maybe find somebody working in your warehouse that's your bloodhound.
Yeah.
And you bring them in there, and this person will have the nose to be able to say, to smell like that. Yeah. And it's interesting. And then winemaking, and that's when people, when I was a winemaker and giving tours, they'd say, you know, why do you, you know, what wine's the right one for me? I said, the one that you like. Because the wine that you may smell something in one wine that you like, and somebody else can't smell it.
Right.
Or you can taste one wine, or one wine tastes sweet to you and doesn't taste sweet to somebody else. Right. You know, so I mean, it's so the old boss who just passed away, a guy named Bill Collins, who was they owned Collin Creek Winery in the 80s. And he said, that's what makes horse races. Really. I mean,
I get that.
Yeah. Because, you know, there's very few wines that everybody agrees on.
That is a fact.
Yeah.
Right. But that's what makes us all individuals.
Yeah.
Between our palates and our noses. Daryl, for our listeners who'd like to learn a little bit more about you and Paramon Online, how would they do that?
They go to the website.
Which is?
Paramon.com.
Okay. Can you spell that for me? Just so we have it?
P-A-R-R-A-M-O-N.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. This has been fascinating. And thanks for the time to sit down with us.
Always love talking about wine and cork.
Me too.
Mm-hmm.
Learn more by visiting ParamonExportTap.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Every wine tells a story. Each growing season, it's our goal to create an artisan Napa Valley wine of exceptional quality. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2017.